And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Jake Lutze grew up in Chapel Hill, and then he wound up in the mountains, and he right next to the Appalachian Trail and a beautiful mountain called Bellevue Mountain. And rock-crushing operation decided to take down Bellevue Mountain and turn it into gravel for your driveway. And Jay and his neighbors set out to stop it. It was really impossible because the rock mining operation had a permit. Jay Lutze found out pretty quickly that North Carolina didn't take back mining permits. But he did it, and he tells the story in a book that's coming out in early June called Stand Up That Mountain, and Jay's back in Chapel Hill to begin to talk a little bit to get us excited about that book, and you got me excited.
Thanks, TG. It is really nice to be in Chapel Hill today. I was at Weaver Street for lunch today, sitting under the trees.
And did it make you want to come back and give up those mountains? And
I don't think
you just like to visit Chapel Hill.
Nothing's going to make me give up those mountains, but I love the opportunity to come home to Chapel Hill. And my mother is here in Chapel Hill, and my sister's family is in Durham, and my brother's family is in Raleigh. And a lot of the work that I do in my career outside of writing is in Raleigh. So this is a great base for me. It's a great place to come home to. And spring arrives a little bit earlier, and summer arrives a little bit earlier in the Piedmont than it does at 4,800 feet in elevation in the southern Appalachians. So it's nice to be here.
Well, before we talk about your book, talk about living on the mountain. I mean, this is crazy what you do. You go up to a really, this is really still wilderness, isn't it? I mean, this is on the side of Yellow Mountain. Some people have hiked by Yellow Mountain, I guess, and seen it, but it's not the place you choose to have a comfortable home life, is it?
It is not a comfortable place to have a home life. That's exactly right. In the summer, it's wonderful. The highest temperature I've ever recorded at my house is 81 degrees. And if it's 81 on Big Yellow Mountain at that elevation, you can be certain that it's well over 100 degrees in Chapel Hill. Mm. So I often call back to the rest of my family and compare notes in the summertime.
Maybe it is more comfortable than any other place. And you could maybe even have a little garden.
That's right. It's very hard to get tomatoes to grow at that elevation. It's very hard to get a growing season long enough. So mountain people generally up around that area grow Christmas trees and cabbages. And you can grow a little bit of corn down in the Tow River Valley.
But on your site, at 4,000 feet, you can't grow anything? Is that?
It's very difficult.
So you don't have a garden?
I don't have a garden except for potatoes. I put potatoes in every year.
And that works?
And then I grow some herbs on the deck. But yeah, beyond that, it's difficult to get a good farm going.
Trying to figure out how you eat. What about the streams? Can you find anything in the streams to eat?
Absolutely. In the springtime, I'm eating ramps and branch lettuce and nettles. Out in the woods. Those are great collectible edibles. I'm a hunter-gatherer, and I can walk to fishing streams, and we've still got Arctic char in the streams that high up, left over from the end of the Pleistocene.
This is something that was real interesting to me, that you've got a fish that I honestly don't remember hearing about before, and it's not native to this region, except that the glaciers brought it down and left them, and there are still a few there.
That's exactly right. It's the same. It's kin to the fish that you find in Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, a brook trout or a speckled trout, mountain people call them. And there is a distinct strain in the southern Appalachians that has a different genotype. And so the high elevation, coldest water streams, you have to have quite cold water to support this species. So we used to have it down in the Yadkin River at lower elevations and throughout the eastern seaboard, but with a changing climate, it can only persist at the highest elevations now.
So as global warming warms you up, we may lose this.
We're quite concerned about this species.
What does it taste like?
It's very tender and delicate. It's a salmonid, so it's not a trout, it's a char. It's a pink-fleshed fish, and I haven't eaten one since I was about 14 years old just because of the catch-and-release ethic.
Oh, wow. But what about with trout? Do you?
I don't mind eating rainbows and browns when I catch those at slightly lower elevation.
And with this other fish, the char, is it char? Is that right?
It is.
It is a good fighting fish? Is it fun to catch?
It's small. They live in parts of the stream that are fairly nutrient poor. So if you catch a 10-inch speckled trout, that's a big fish. That's a big speckled trout. But you're fishing with very light gear, so you might be fishing with a 2-weight fly rod, and so it still puts up a good little fight.
Well, you love your mountains, and you mentioned earlier that you have been in and out of the Christmas tree business, and you know you went up there to write, I think, but Christmas tree farming is not. Well, you have to work to do that, but do you grow them or do you just get them from your neighbors and distribute them?
I have a neighbor that's got a large Christmas tree farm operation, and they're growing Fraser firs, which is a native tree from the spruce fir forest up on Roan Mountain, Mitchell Mountain. You have this species of fir, the Fraser fir, named for a Scottish botanist in the 1800s who discovered this species. It was named in his honor, and it's a wonderful Christmas tree because it retains its moisture better than any other evergreen. And so it's virtually fireproof. If you tried to set it on fire, you'd have a very difficult time getting it to burn. But it has a wonderful scent when you cut the boughs. And so the nursery and shrubbery industry in Avery County, along with tourism, are the two top industries.
Well, how do you make money on Christmas trees? I mean, it takes a while to grow. You got to
takes 8 or 9 years to get your 7-foot Christmas tree.
Then you got to deal with some middleman like you who's got to make some money.
And I sold them far too cheap. I did not make a lot of money. I was not the best businessman.
Are you out of that business now?
I am out of that business now.
Tell us about how does it work? How does the farmer make a living?
The farmer makes a living oftentimes because they're on inherited land. And if you went out to buy land on the open marketplace today, given what's happened to property values, you could not make it work. You could not establish a new Christmas tree farm now. But you have a lot of folks that are land rich in the mountains, and they've been looking for some productive use. And the Christmas tree industry was well supported by NC State and a lot of the extension services in North Carolina have helped the Christmas tree farmers come up with viable strains that are relatively pest resistant and some good methods for growing trees to a viable size. And this is the Cadillac of Christmas trees, the North Carolina Fraser fir.
So you can get $100.
Yeah, you can. You can get $100 for a 9-foot tree. You can get $100.
That would make it, when you talk about that much money, you can think about growing it and delivering it to a Chapel Hill customer and maybe giving everybody some fair return.
But the market has changed quite a bit with, you've noticed in the past several years that Lowe's and Home Depot and grocery stores are selling Christmas trees in great volume now. And a business that used to be sort of on the street corner, folks would come down from the mountains in a truck with 40 trees and they'd sell their crop. That is disappearing a little bit.
And what has that done? I mean,
it's driven the prices down, and it's also made farmers plant more intensively. And right now what we're seeing is a shift to artificial trees. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Christmas tree farmers right now in the mountains are hurting.
So there's, like everything else that gets popular, there becomes a time when there's an oversupply.
That's right. And that's the cycle that we're in right now.
Well, you're up there on the mountain peacefully writing away novels that haven't yet sold, and what happens? What happens that got you off on this mission regarding saving a mountain from a rock crushing? What happened?
Well, I went to the mountain. I left a job in a city in order to be in the woods and have solitude where I would have a place to write and collect my thoughts. And literally one day while I was sitting at my desk, I started hearing trees falling. And my dogs noticed it first. My dogs have very sensitive hearing, and they heard trees falling in the forest, but not anywhere where we could see. It was off in the distance. And
you hear about this, if a tree falls down and makes a noise, but nobody's there to hear it. Is there a sound? But how far will the sound of a tree falling Carry.
I learned a lot about this. A big tree, and this was sort of a second growth forest. These trees are about 80 years old, typically up on Bellevue Mountain, and that sound easily crossed the gap of a mile and a half to my desk. And I could hear the chainsaws. I could hear the backup beepers.
I can hear that, but did you actually hear the crunch? What does it sound like? Crunch?
It's not quite crunch. It's sort of a percussion, like a drum from a distance. And so it's faint enough that you can ignore it for a while. But after 4 or 5 days of trees falling and chainsaws running, I decided to investigate and see what was causing the racket. And I asked around the community, and very quickly the postmistress at the Minneapolis post office, Louise Buchanan, said, "Well, that's Paul Brown's rock crusher going in, and that's going to be the biggest surface mine in Western North Carolina."
And she was happy about it?
She was pleased as she could be about
it. She must not live too near.
She thought that was going to put Dogtown, which is the nickname of our little town, on the map for having this rock crushing operation. And she saw that it was an opportunity for jobs and maybe road widening and some changes in the community that she thought might be positive.
She had no suspicion at that moment that you might not be too happy about it?
She had no suspicion at that moment. To her, it was clear that this was a good thing to come into the community.
Well, did anybody think it was a bad thing up there? They need jobs. They need all these things, the postmistress.
Those are good points. We've just talked about the changes in the Christmas tree industry, for example, and this is a part of my county and a part of Western North Carolina that is very poor. Outside of the resort areas around Beach Mountain and Sugar Mountain, Avery County ranks very high in things that you do not want to rank high in. And the level of poverty is out of balance with what you'd want to have in your community.
Well, if we think of Avery County just as to try to put it on the map for Chapel Hill people, I hear some pretty nice things. There's a Lees McRae College is Grandfather Mountain, I think.
Grandfather Mountain is in several counties, yeah, but it's also in Avery County.
In Avery, as you mentioned, Sugar Mountain is Beach Mountain.
That's right, yep.
Linville, is it in
it? It is. Linville is in Avery County.
That's right. This sounds like pretty high cotton to me.
It's a very interesting community because what you have tended to see in Avery County is gated communities with extremely high wealth and outside the gates an extremely high rate of poverty.
Kind of like, don't want to get too close to them, kind of like northern Chatham County maybe, in the sense that you've got a mixture of very high-end, some gated communities and some not, but
I think it's
that there's still some remaining struggling rural remnants of the old Chatham County.
It's an apt analogy, and what you have in the mountains is this topography that leads to sort of a bifurcation in the education levels and in the level of communication. Avery County, most folks there on my side of the county, which is the side hugging the Tennessee line, identify themselves by their creek. And each creek will have several churches and several family names that are easily identifiable. In Roaring Creek, it's Hughes and Burleson's. In Little Horse Creek, it's Taylor's and Young's and Vance's. And so I could go creek by creek around the Rhone Highlands, which is where I live, and tell you what family settled that creek bed and is still hanging on there.
We're visiting with Jay Lutze. Jay's book will be coming out in early June. In fact, on June 7th at 6:30 at the Barn in Farrington will be his launch party. Anyway, is everybody invited?
Everybody's invited. Kibi Fitch is throwing open the doors of the barn. Her wonderful store out there, McIntyre's, is hosting the book launch for me. I've known Kibi for many, many years, and I've just watched really in awe at what Kibi has done for the world of books in our state and in our region. She has really assumed positions of leadership among independent booksellers in this country, and I'm really proud of her, and I'm really honored that she asked if she could host the book launch.
Well, she's going to sell a lot of books, and you're going to be signing a lot of books. The book is published by Schreiber, and that's quite a coup. We might talk a little bit, Jay, after a couple of breaks about how in the world you snagged this great national publisher to publish your first book. Jay Lutze, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jay Lutze. Jay is the author of a book which is going to be published in about a month on June 7th. Launch party at Farrington. And the book is Stand Up That Mountain. And Jay, you grew up in Chapel Hill. For those who joined us late, you abandoned Chapel Hill and moved to the west side of Yellow Mountain. Have I got this, the geography right?
Northwest? East side. East side of Big Yellow.
I'm sorry, yeah, facing this way.
That's right.
Maybe that's why I never got promoted to general in the Army. Jay, you talked about learning from the postmistress about a quarry, I guess, a mine, a rock mine. But these mountains, I guess, are developed along a like Chapel Hill and affect maybe some kind of old volcanic rock that's covered up by dirt. But if you wanted to get some rock, you could probably do it right here in Chapel Hill the same way. But it's really messy. And you, it was annoying to you. What got you started? What made you get into the business of really spending virtually full time on stopping it?
Well, I had been interested for years in conservation, DG, I think you know, and I know we share a passion for that. Both of my parents were conservationists. The Nature Conservancy's North Carolina chapter had some of its first meetings in my living room as a child on this mountain. The first preserves that they acquired were at Bluff Mountain and Big Yellow Mountain. So the top of the mountain that I live on was protected by the Nature Conservancy and Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy in 1974. And it hosts, outside the Arctic Circle, one of the most remarkable arrays of Arctic relic species that you'll find, the largest colony of Arctic oak grass. So it's a botanical wonderland. I sort of grew up taking it for granted, thinking that that's what the mountains were all about. But what you learn on Big Yellow Mountain is that on these grassy balds, which are spectacular scenically, that they host these rare species, and you have this grass layer and then a soil layer, but these mountains are granite. And when you talk about the rock crushing operation, some rock crushes a little bit more softly than other types of rock.
No, I didn't know
granite is a particularly loud rock to crush.
It's hard and it's hard to break up.
That's right.
So you've got to. I think about comparing it about what annoys me in Chapel Hill, and that is leaf blowers.
You know?
And so my neighbors, at the moment I want to take a nap, decide, well, they don't blow their leaves. They hire somebody to come blow their leaves. And then I forget, when we hire somebody to blow our leaves, that we might be annoying somebody else. But a rock crusher dwarfs, I guess, that experience. It might even dwarf the Harley Davidson that goes by my house that's been geared up to make as much noise as it can.
It's an interesting comparison. The leaf blower example is a very good one because it's one a lot of people relate to. You always have an expectation that the leaf blower will stop eventually. With a rock quarry, the leaf blowing sound lasts for about 3 weeks continuously during daylight hours. That's the drilling. So in order to crush rock and make the roads that we all drive on, you drill for several weeks into granite, and then you pack those holes with dynamite and you blow a chunk out of the mountain, out of the granite, and then you transport that granite, and those boulders may be half the size of the room that we're sitting in, and then they go into a crusher jaw and they get tumbled around and crushed into smaller size, about the size of a microwave oven. Then they go to a secondary crusher.
All this is making, each one of these operations makes the same amount of noise, or there's
they all make terrific racket. In fact, I wrote a report for the state for as they were doing an acoustic analysis of what this crusher sounded like. Not just because it was noisy, but because it was noisy from a national park unit, from the Appalachian Trail on Big Hump Mountain. And I sat on Big Hump Mountain the day that they did a test blast and a test crush to monitor the acoustic impacts. And not everybody there from the state, from the agency that issued the permit, was able to attend, so I wrote a report that I thought would be helpful. And I compared it to the sound of a vacuum cleaner at the end of the hallway that runs for 3 weeks, followed by the sound of a ski boot tumbling in a clothes dryer. And that is the sound that I was standing to hear from my house and from my favorite national trail, national park, which is the Appalachian Trail.
So a lot of noise pollution, and that the noise pollution is what personally affected you because, as I remember, you couldn't see the scar developing.
That's true.
So I wondered, well, if somebody had been able to figure out a quiet way to crush rock, would Jay have been so upset? And would he have had the passion to do it?
It's a great question because I do think that the most visceral response to the activity at the mine was that constant, unending sound impact. And it was interesting, the Appalachian Trail Conference, which has a congressional authorization to create and protect the trail, wrote a purpose statement. When they had to try to identify what it was, what values it was trying to protect in creating the nation's footpath from Georgia to Maine. And they referred specifically to the creation of a quiet remove from the sights and sounds of civilization, because they identified early on that that is why people go to the Appalachian Trail. They have an expectation of a wilderness walk in the woods. And there are many things that would be inconsistent with that wilderness experience. Bright lights would be inconsistent. Shopping centers along the edge of the trail, parking lots would be inconsistent with your experience as you walk the trail. And loud noises are inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Now, a loud noise that you hear briefly may not cause a significant adverse effect on your experience. On the grassy balds of the Roan Highlands, where this impact was taking place, this is the place in the southern half of the Appalachian Trail that people go to linger. Mm. Mm. This is where people go to take in the views of Mount Rogers, Mount Jefferson, Grandfather Mountain, Mount Mitchell.
You can see Mount Rogers and Mount Jefferson from there, all the way up in Virginia.
You can see Mount Sterling from Big Hump Mountain, 70 miles away in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So yes, you can see the Virginia, the Grayson
and
Highlands area.
Is this at the ball, and it's the ball on your mountain, or is it
There's a series of balls that
the balls are. I guess, gosh, I'm talking insider now because you brought me into it. But a mountain ball is the top of one of our great mountains. It's not forested. It's naturally just clear, and so you get up there and instead of being surrounded by trees, you can actually see the mountains.
That's right. It feels like grassy meadows on top of mountains at elevations of up to 6,000 feet. It's a stunning landscape, and there are many reasons we believe grassy balds are treeless, and the theories that have gained the most credibility over time in the botanical community is that these balds have always been open.
So this is a special place that you found, that you treasured, and you found many people who hike the trail have a memory of this experience, of this view, as one of the highlights of their trail hike. But and so your point is that the trail, this is part of the trail, is this communion with nature. But look, I mean, if you hike the trail all the way to Maine, you're going to cross highways, you're going to go through, have to go through towns and experience across railroad tracks and have all kinds of interruptions for this experience. So you can't argue, can you, that it's that Congress and the Statement of Missions has provided, it may be aspirationally, but it
right.
can't really provide an uninterrupted.
It's a difficult time to be a linear national park. it really is. The Blue Ridge Parkway and the Appalachian Trail are two linear national park units, and the encroachments on these linear units are manifold. And all along the Blue Ridge Parkway, we see inconsistent development creeping up because developers want to be able to advertise proximity to the Blue Ridge Parkway. It's another national park. Now, it's not all in one big chunk of a unit the way Yellowstone National Park is, or Great Smoky Mountains National Park, for that matter. And so the challenges are unique in trying to manage this kind of resource. And I believe North Carolina's mining statute is actually quite well written in many respects. It asks that the official issuing permits considers whether there are impacts of a mining operation that will have a significant adverse effect on several things: hospitals, schools, water supplies, and the purpose of publicly owned parks, forests, and recreation areas. So this is not only a publicly owned park, forest, and recreation area. This is a national park, which gets the highest level of scrutiny. And not only is this a national park, but this is a part of a national park that is on these grassy balds. So there's almost nowhere else along the Appalachian Trail where you would give this much scrutiny to the experience that the user is having.
We're visiting with Jay Luzzi. We're talking to him in connection with his upcoming book, Stand Up That Mountain, and he and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Jay Luzzi is my guest. He's the author of Stand Up That Mountain. Jay grew up in Chapel Hill, but he lives in the mountains. And the book and what he's talking to us about now is all about stopping a quarrying operation that was going to have a big impact on the viewshed of the hikers for the Appalachian Trail and nuisance noises for other people who were permanent residents of the mountain area. Jay, one of the things that it shouldn't have surprised me, but you know, the Appalachian Trail is a treasure for those of us who think about it and dream about it and sometimes hike on it. And we have some people who've hiked the whole, you know, what do you call them?
Through hikers.
Through hikers who've started out in the spring down in Georgia and hiked all the way to Maine. So it's a part of American culture. But all these great mountain people who live in these valleys, when you started talking to them about protecting the Appalachian Trail, what did they say to you?
What they said very clearly in my first meeting with the folks who soon became my co-plaintiffs was, we're more worried about our foundation than we are that little dirt path.
The foundation of their house.
That's exactly right.
So, is that a, you know, you think if we had an Appalachian Trail, or if we had a park like that, or if we had a great university, we would, sometimes I guess if you're a local, you ignore the kinds of things that other people who come visit you think might be precious.
I think I would have had an easy sell at Weaver Street today explaining the impacts on the Appalachian Trail. But in my local community, people were much more concerned about their drinking water supply and the noise and the visual impacts from their homes. But the immediate concern was public safety. There were two houses in particular owned by adjoining landowners who were, the foundation on one of them was cracked by the initial dynamite blast when the mining company sought to put their crusher jaw into the side of the mountain. And that's what prompted a call to me that led to my involvement in the case.
And so let's talk about those two neighbors, or two sets of neighbors that you had. You would think that if these people were really that impacted, next door to this rock crushing operation, you could get them to do just about anything. But you got one of them, I mean, you got both of them lined up to be plaintiffs in your lawsuit, and then what happened?
Well, one of them would have walked with me through the valley of death. Whatever it took, Ollie Cox was going to fight this permit until the end, because her rights were violated when the state issued this permit without holding public hearings first.
This is the permit to open the and operate the, I'll just call it the rock mine.
In order to open any mining operation in the state of North Carolina and disturb more than 1 acre of soil, you must first secure a mining permit in the state of North Carolina. You must, in order to qualify for it, notify all the adjoining landowners to the site of their right to seek a public hearing. That's where you find out if there's a hospital next door, or a school, or an imperiled drinking water supply, or a house that's quite close. Mm-hmm. In this case, the mining engineer who submitted the permit application pulled the permit boundary in 50 feet and then said, voila, we don't adjoin anybody, and gave no notice. And in a very rare case.
Because they didn't have to, because there were no adjoining landowners.
Well, there were 16 adjoining landowners.
They weren't, because they that property was not part of the mine.
That's right.
So and that's an oldest trick in the book as far as developing real estate. In fact, we've gone through that in Chapel Hill, where in a project, the adjoining landowners had certain rights, and so the and they blocked the project. So the developer went back and compacted the project a little bit and set up a separate boundary. And so he removed the adjoining landowners from being adjoining landowners. What's wrong with that?
Well, as they say, that's what makes horse races, and that's why and that's why we have courts, because that matter had to be litigated, whether you could eliminate adjoining landowners by drawing your line 50 feet in.
What did the courts finally say about that?
Well, the courts referenced that. The Court of Appeals referenced that. They really held in the Court of Appeals that we won because the permit did create significant adverse effects on the purpose of the Appalachian Trail, and that once the state discovers its error, it must correct it.
It can correct it. It can withdraw a permit if
that's
messed up. Even if the permittee is damaged economically.
That's right. And they also noted that the mining company could not claim certain protections having to do with notice, because the notice question was contested from the very beginning by the plaintiffs.
I see. Well, I interrupted you and got you off on another target, but you emphasized the participation of one tenacious plaintiff. The more poignant part of the story was the plaintiff who was maybe even more significantly damaged, but who, for one reason or another, refused at the end to become a named plaintiff. And that's an important part of the story.
It was a dark moment in the case. We had our plaintiffs lined up, and we walked to the Avery County Courthouse to file our complaint with the clerk of court. And Faye Williams, whose house was virtually wrapped around by the mining permit, asked to withdraw her name from the permit.
Or from the
complaint. And we had carefully crafted the complaint, and Faye's case was critical to what we thought would be our chance of success. And she withdrew.
What was going through her mind?
Faye was concerned that her husband would be unhappy with her if this was in the paper that she was one of the legal contestants.
But he's living in this house. Somebody's damaged the house. His wife is going crazy because of the damage.
And it was her family's property. And so you never know what's going on in somebody's household. But it was clear that her husband was weighing some of the local community's feelings about jobs and benefits of the quarrying operation.
So her husband is a regular mountain person, and his buddies want a job. And he's a part of the, if it weren't for his house, he'd be a part of the support network for the
mine. It was a house divided.
Well,
it was very poignant to me as well.
Whatever happened, but Faye continued to support you, didn't you? I mean, she wanted you to win.
Faye even attended the Court of Appeals hearing. She drove down from Minneapolis to Raleigh and sat with me in the Court of Appeals hearing, where we ultimately won the case.
But you had to have mixed feelings about this woman who had pulled the rug out from under you. I mean, did you ever get over it?
I have gotten over it, and Faye and I are still friends, and she's just retired from Lees McRae College, where she worked in the library, and she's a wonderful person. She is staunch in her beliefs, but people sometimes have other things going on in their lives that mean that decisions like these are not easy to make.
We're visiting with Jay Lutze. We're talking about his upcoming new book, Stand Up That Mountain. It'll be, I hadn't been reading the subtitle, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail. That's almost a book in itself.
We fought over that subtitle quite a bit with my editor at Simon & Schuster and the good folks at Scribner, and we finally narrowed it down to that, if you can believe it. That's the short version.
We'll talk about it. Well, on another occasion, we're going to talk about this. We're going to take a break. But before we take the break, the launch party for this book will be June 7th at 6:30 at the Barn in Farrington, and you're invited. Jay Lutze and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Jay Lucey and I are talking about his new book, which is going to be launched on June 6th at June 7th. At Barrington, will that be set? Is that a? Is it a? Do you remember what day it is?
A look. It is. It's a weekday. I think it's a Thursday.
Well, we'll look and talk about it. You think it's Thursday? In any event, mark June 7th on your calendar, and we're just going to stop and check because June 7th is a Thursday.
Please come.
And Jay, you got a special invitation from Jay. Be lots of books sold on that day. And I promise you'll be reading about this a lot in the newspapers in the next few weeks and thereafter. Jay, we've just started about the beginnings of your book, and we're not going to have time to talk about every part of it. But as you think back, and you've had to, as you've pulled all of your memories together in this book, I mean, what's the lesson? What's the message? What does the book do other than just tell a really good story?
Well, thanks, T.G. It's to me, it fits in so appropriately to the rest of the work that I do in conservation. And I buy land for a conservation organization out of Asheville, Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy. And I raise money to buy land from the trust funds that the state of North Carolina has and from the federal government and the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And it strikes me that this is an expensive, costly way to protect land. And this was a costly battle in my life. I spent 4 years on this battle, as did the other co-plaintiffs, and it was very stressful. I met heroes that mean a lot to me, Trip Van Oppen.
And Trip works in Chapel Hill, and tell us about him. I think he spends all of his time at his desk or in the courtroom.
Trip did work in Chapel Hill, right. And he ran the Carolinas Office of Southern Environmental Law Center. He is now the president of Earth Justice in California, and he is doing the kind of work that he did for us nationwide.
Well,
and the nation is richer for it.
Well, let's talk about the organization that he led, which lives in Chapel Hill, or at least its branch office is in Chapel Hill. And what did it do for you?
Southern Environmental Law Center saved my tail. It saved my nest egg. It meant that I did not have to become penniless to stay in court, because I was prepared to do that. I was prepared to spend all I had, which was not much, but I was able to hire a private attorney along with my neighbors. We put together a legal defense fund that totaled about $18,000, which is a lot of money, but that doesn't go far in legal fees. And Southern Environmental Law Center takes their cases for free. Now, they only take cases that will set precedents, because they have to use their own resources very wisely, but they helped in drafting our complaints and represented us in court, and they survive on grants and private donations.
One of the poignant parts of your story, you mentioned that the Nature Conservancy might have gotten started in your living room here in Chapel Hill, but when you went to see Catherine, that was a disappointment that the Nature Conservancy wasn't in the business of helping people like you on this.
That's right. And now, working for a land trust, I understand a lot better what was going on with my great friends at the Nature Conservancy. Catherine Skinner is one of the most remarkable people I know. She's saved hundreds of thousands of acres in North Carolina. But Catherine was very clear with me, as she has a way of doing, saying that we are not going to get mixed up in your legal fight. And now I'm grateful, the amount of work that I do with the Nature Conservancy, that they steer clear of controversy when possible. They work best when they can collaborate with landowners who are willing sellers.
It's an interesting, your book pointed out the interesting division that there is in the way of responsibilities in the environment, in the Protect the Environment movement, in that there are some who have to cozy up to those people in power and to work with them and to understand their needs. And one of their needs is not to be sued and harassed, as you were threatening to do. And then there's another group, and we're talking about Southern Environmental Law Centers in this part of it, and that is that their business is to be respected because, I don't want to say they're mean, but that they're tough. And if you don't do right, they will sue you no matter how respected you are.
That's right.
So you've been on both sides. Where do you want to be?
For myself, I like to buy land first that is prioritized for conservation. When possible, when you have a willing seller and you've identified the high conservation value, I like to try to buy that land and transfer it to an appropriate state agency. Sometimes that's the Division of State Parks. Sometimes it's Pisgah National Forest. That's the cleanest, easiest, most collaborative way to work. And in my career, I don't really deal with regulatory policy, which is a relief because that's a tough swamp to wade into. But I appreciate so much that there are certain times after you've tried everything else and you have critical stakes, as we often have in the environment of North Carolina, this fragile state, that there's a group like the Southern Environmental Law Center as a backstop. And I have to say, when they sue, most of the state agencies that they end up having to sue, they're often greeted with some trepidation, but also with respect, because they carry themselves very professionally. And everyone knows, once they've been sued by the Southern Environmental Law Center, that every other possible remedy has been exhausted.
Well, lots more to talk about with Jay Lutze, about his new book, Stand Up the Mountain, Stand Up That Mountain, which will be on sale on Thursday, June 7th, and at beginning at a launch party at Farrington, 6:30 in the evening. If you have a chance, don't miss it. Jay, thanks for taking all this time to visit us, and thanks for this wonderful book.
Thank you, DG. I'm going to go back to Weaver Street now.
Go back to Weaver Street. All right, and come back more often, and we'll come visit you in your Yellow Mountain to see these beautiful vistas that you describe in your book. Our guest has been Jay Lutze. Thanks to you for listening. DG Martin here. I'll be right back here soon. In fact, I'll be back here before you know it.